The information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice or treatment. If you're concerned about your health in any way, we encourage you to consult your GP.
People don't like talking about it, but incontinence can affect anyone. You may have a friend or relative who lives with it every day, or maybe you're worried about your own incontinence. Incontinence Talks is here to make us all feel more confident about continence, hosted by former Olympian rower and Coloplast ambassador Pete Reed. In this episode, Pete is talking to Jack and Hannah Gagan from Coloplast about their own experience with incontinence and the importance of finding the right continence care products.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Incontinence Talks. I'm Pete Reed, and today I'm joined by Jack Emkiss and Hannah Gagan. Jack is a fellow Coloplast ambassador. Hannah is the head of government affairs and patient advocacy for Coloplast. Welcome, both of you. Thank you so much for coming. Can I start with you, Jack?
Of course.
I love your dynamism and your passion and your experience. Would you mind starting off with just telling us all a little bit about your ISC journey?
I sort of see my life as sort of ACBC. BC was before catheters. I thought catheters were like sort of hose pipes that old ladies put inside them when then, and I thought that was normal. I was a teacher. I've got four children. And before that, I was an accountant, which is all a bit weird. So my career came to a juddering halt after a very routine hysterectomy. I was teaching maths to grumpy secondary school teenagers, and every so often my whole body would just devolve itself of blood because of massive fibroids. And I tried all sorts of medication and ended up with elective surgery.
So how did that present? Sorry to interrupt you.
Normal bleeding for a woman is obviously, as we all know, periods, which can be heavier or less. But when it's fibroids, you could just empty blood everywhere at a moment's notice. You can actually feel it, but by then it's too late. So you always wear black trousers, which is significant because I still wear black trousers, but not for the blood, for the urine. And so it is incredibly difficult to manage. Doctors will give you all sorts of medication, and there's something called a marina coil, which also is, I think it's a hormone replacement, which is supposed to help, but it doesn't. That's why I made the decision to go for elective surgery.
What year is this?
That was 2009.
Okay.
So I was in my 40s. I went to see my head teacher, and he said, "Oh, Jack, hysterectomy, that's quite worrying. You'll come back even more energetic than you are already. 6 weeks recovery." It's always 6 weeks. 6 weeks recovery. It's marvellous. So that's what I went for. I thought, great, that's not a problem. Had my 6 weeks off and really was feeling pretty rough, but went back to school, saw a physio and said, "You know, you're not normal." I said, "I know that." She said, "No, really, you're really not normal." So cutting an incredibly long story short, what had happened during the hysterectomy was that my right ureter had been cut. And so to fix that, the local surgeon cut the top of my bladder and made it into a tube. Very clever to join it up with what remained of my ureter to join to my kidney.
I'm just going to remind us that the ureter is the pipe from the kidney to the bladder. And we've got two kidneys, one left and one right. So your right side pipe.
Absolutely right.
Okay.
As opposed to what's similar, of course, is urethra, which will get all the bladder out of your, all the urine out of your bladder. So then that didn't work either. I had lots of indwelling catheters. I had suprapubic catheter. I was then sent to London. Operation was repeated. That went wrong. So I had a bag on my left leg for my left kidney, and I had a bag on my right leg for my right kidney, which was coming out of my back. That's quite difficult to walk when you're doing that. But anyway, it's quite easy to empty your bags, especially if you're sitting at a barbecue and there's an empty wine bottle. You just sort of empty the bag. It's very easy and just hope no one drinks it. I'm not actually joking either.
I mean, Jax, I've emptied my stoma bag in a bin on Hackney Road getting off a bus.
It's the only
absolutely.
Way.
It's the only way to do it, yeah.
I've done it in a theatre as well. I bought a very expensive bottle of water at the bar because the loo queue was so long. So I went and got a bottle of water at great expense and went back and sat in my seat in darkness and emptied my catheter bag that way.
So I haven't had a bag to empty since I've been in hospital, but I have catheterized on a plane under a blanket into a bag there.
There's no room in the plane toilets.
I can't get there even if I wanted to.
Can't fit in.
Yeah, the things you do, like these little
top tips,
little tricks to navigate your normal processes in society. I want to go back just quickly to the physio, who noticed something wasn't quite right. Presumably, you didn't know that the ureter on the right side had been cut. So what's happening in your body at that point? There's waste product just coming down into your body, and you must have, I guess, looked pale.
So
risk of infection.
A lot of pain, infection.
Okay. Yeah.
I just kept taking my antibiotics dutifully and trying to teach. And I remember going for a scan when one of my colleagues covered my very naughty class for me. And after the scan, they said, you really need to wait and see the consultant because you actually need to be in hospital. I said, I'm so sorry, I've got to go. I'm supposed to be doing detention. I can't possibly stay. So I did it. I went back to school because that's what you want to do. You want to just be normal.
Yeah.
And block it out. So.
And people always think operations are going to be absolutely fine.
You're going to be fine. You go to hospital and you get better.
Yeah.
So the next thing that happened was that they decided that really this was not going to work. So I gave my right kidney to a recipient in North London. And he and I correspond. And he, I think, is a lot fitter than me. So my right kidney did something good, and that's a real positive. After that, I stopped using indwelling catheters and was really not feeling on top form. School were fantastic. I had a very reduced timetable and kind of did what I could. In the end, I went for urodynamics, which was a completely ridiculous test. But it proves what your patient is saying. The patient says, I can't empty my bladder. And the doctor does this enormous urodynamic test that I call 50 shades of grey. You're sort of strapped on. You've got nothing on. You've got all the male doctors watching you. They stuff a catheter up your bum. They stuff a catheter into your bladder. And then they say, cough. And you say, well, I am coughing. Can you feel your bladder? No, I told you I can't feel my bladder. Okay, we'll just fill it up, get to a litre. Can you feel it? No. Can you cough? Yeah, that's okay. And then
they filled it up to a litre.
They raise the X-ray bed and you're strapped on.
So I know about video urodynamics.
Have you done urodynamics?
I've done it and I know what, I can relate to the 50 Shades of Grey, but
you've probably got ladies watching you.
Well, I do. Yeah,
yeah.
I did.
Well, I have men.
Okay,
yeah.
Funny old thing.
Yeah, it's weird.
But they put a catheter in, up your pee hole, up your urethra.
And one in your bum.
And fill you up. One in the bum, that's a pressure sensor, isn't it?
Yeah.
So they get a digital readout of what's going on.
And they find that you can't pee.
They find that you were telling the truth.
Yeah. It's like a lie test, actually. So it's quite fun.
From that point, when they know you're telling the truth, and I think we're just about to go from indwelling catheter to self-catheterisation.
It was at that very point, the consultant said, you're going to just have to self-catheterise. I had no idea, even with the experience I'd already had, that even these gadgets existed. I was ushered in to see a nurse. I lay down on a bed. I was given a mirror and told how to self-catheterise, as in poke it into your urethra, lying down with a mirror. Well, I was a bit cross-eyed and I just couldn't see. I couldn't quite get it. And so she said, you'll be fine. And gave me a packet of catheters to take home. And on the train, to be perfectly honest, it was one time. I don't often cry, but that day I cried all the way home on the train. I just thought, I'm not going to be able to do this. I can't do it. Got home, shut myself in the bathroom, and I lay down on the bathroom floor because I thought that's what you did. You're lying down. To catheter. I said, how can you lie down? My bathroom's not big enough for me to lie down.
Jack, it breaks my heart to hear that you were breaking down on the way home. And I just wonder, what difference would it have made to you if you had known about ISC before that moment in your life, like pivotal time?
That's such a good question. I would have perhaps had a little bit of more confidence that this was something that was going to work. My embarrassment, I suppose, at not being able to actually get that catheter in with the mirror lying down on a trolley was because I thought I would never, ever be able to do this. If I'd had some prior information, if I'd been able to talk to another patient, if I'd been able to talk to you, you maybe would have said to me, you've got to give it a go. You've got to try it. If it doesn't work lying down, which it doesn't, then how about standing? How about standing in the shower? How about sitting on the toilet? And just really, it's not rocket science, is it? But just that complete, complete ignorance on my part. I'd never heard of it, didn't know anything about it. And there I was trying to jab this catheter into my fanny what's it. It was horrendous, horrendous. Anyway, long story short, I kind of got the hang of it. And the first catheters I had, you sort of squeezed a bag, lubrication came squirting out. Then you open the top of it and that pours all over your clothes and your hands and what have you. And then you insert it, empty your bladder, but then you put that back in the wet, soggy, horrible bag. And generally at home, that's okay. But when you're traveling, when you're on a train, etc., that is horrendous. I then...
Why is that horrendous? Is it a reuse catheter?
No, single but use? It just makes such a mess.
And that matters, right? So what you get on your clothes and...
Everywhere.
So a dignity thing?
Dignity, yeah. Your hands, etc. I then actually had to go for a spinal surgery because of all the infections that had happened with the right kidney that had really destroyed the disc in the lower part of my back. So I had... a cage and screws and a fusion, effectively, of the lower part of my back. And that was actually quite illuminating because then I refused to have an indwelling catheter. So I had a disposable catheter, but had a bag on the end of it. So actually lying down, because you can't move after spinal surgery, as I'm sure you know, I could actually self-catheterize because it just went into the bag. And that suddenly I felt quite confident that actually whatever was wrong with my back, which at that time I wasn't sure, I was going to cope with this. I could still get the pee out and not have an indwelling. So from that day on, I started self-catheterizing, recovered eventually from spinal surgery, carried on teaching as best I could. And then along came the most amazing women's health physio. He said, you know what, Jack, there are other sorts of catheters. And to my embarrassment, I said, I had no idea. And she actually began to work for Coloplast after that. But she got loads of samples for me to try, different sizes, different lubricants. Ones have anesthetic on, ones have lots of solution, some you add the solution to. And so that's why I ended up with what was then called Eve. And that was the beginning of a much better CISC life.
And that's,
I've gabbled on, but that is the story.
So I haven't stopped you because it's been fascinating. Some things I can really relate to as well, especially not knowing that other products are available. Some parts where you were talking about getting your independence back, I think, with a normal process of peeing. I think after you had your spinal surgery, finding joy in the independence of going again, okay, this time to a bag, but it was a product that allowed you to get your independence back. So for me, that was reclaiming my identity in those
exactly.
processes. And that's important.
And you can't, if you're confident, you can do anything. When you begin to doubt your ability to cope, you can't do anything.
Yeah, so yeah, despair and despondency sets in. And I wouldn't blame anybody for feeling that way either. If they've had a bad run, some bad luck, a bad product, some bad advice, it's easy to be despondent, especially when your dignity is stripped a little bit and there's a lack of understanding. And I think that's why we're here discussing these things. We've talked at length through the series about all of these issues, these loo taboos that cropped up, And I'm really excited to finish this series with an episode about the importance of innovation. So where catheter products have come from, where stoma products have come from, where irrigation products have come from, because people have been suffering with incontinence throughout the dawn of time. And in the last 100 years, we've been able to do something about it. In the last 10 years, it's been a lot better. And in the last few months, it's been incredible. And I'm excited because the future is really bright. We're talking about this stuff openly. It's very hard to find anything online or in the public eye about incontinence.
I think that's something that I feel very strongly about, that I don't know where people can go for a trusted source of information. There's some excellent charities, but they're not signposted out of the NHS sites. In fact, the NHS site doesn't really say very much.
Well, I know you're hugely experienced here. You're a patient advocate as well. Hannah, you've been quiet because I think we've both been listening to Jack,
yeah.
Just sort of grateful that someone's saying what we've been wanting to hear for
Absolutely.
So long. But what are your experiences of incontinence and products that are being used? And then we'll go from there to innovations.
Well, it feels like it's going to be a bit of a competition between Jax and I about how many surgeries we've had. But I think we've got enough of those pink forms that you signed to probably decorate quite a large hall of some variety. But so I suppose this one is an interesting one for me because I work at Coloplast, but it's not really a secret to anybody that I have a stoma. I have advocated on behalf of people who have stomas for, I think, ever since I got mine. I even remember in the hospital bed, because I was at the Royal London at the time, before it was the nice Royal London. So it was very, it was like Elizabethan. It was like super, it was very, very dark. Very dark time, very dark place.
You mind me asking what year?
I've got it tattooed. Actually, my first surgery was the 17th of the 1st, 08. And my final surgery, I came out a year later on the 29th of the 1st, 09. So I lived in hospital for a year, majority of that in isolation. So
that's not easy time.
It was horrific. It was like doing a sentence or something, I'm sure. I mean, I don't know what that's like, but it was bad for me. But I think it was probably even worse for my parents and my friends, because they don't have any control. And actually, I do think one of the saddest things I saw was people coming in and out of the hospital, people dying, and they had no one. And I think that when we talk about patient advocacy and we talk about why these things matter, having somebody in your corner to fight is one of the biggest strengths you can have. And if you don't have family and friends to do that, then the charities are incredibly important. There are resources we can happily like signpost to those. But I mean, that fight kind of came in me. I remember when they were bringing like the food trolley round, and the food was like, it was terrible. And I was like, how are you expecting people to be able to recover when the food is terrible? So like day 15 or something post-surgery, I was already lobbying in hospital. I got the food manager down. We got it all like sorted out. And I knew then that there was something in me. So when I had my first stoma surgery, I came to it through ulcerative colitis. So like Crohn's disease, so IBD, as we call it, bowel disease. I was at university. I just saw blood in my poo, basically. And I really struggled to get through my final years at university, so much so that they said, you're just going to have to stop. But then I was like, I'm not going to. So I took a placement working for a lobbying firm in London. And I did that. And that was like in Milbank Tower in the old days. So it's like proper old school lobbying. It was fascinating. And then I went to work for a non-departmental public body. And then actually I went to work for Mercury Cancer Care, because they were fighting for the right to die at home. And for me, because I'd had palliative care and almost died about six times, it felt deeply important that now I was still around and had a voice, that I should try and lend that to others. And then I moved into pharmaceuticals and I've done other things. And then I ended up at Coloplast, which is this perfect combination of having a condition and having a stoma, but also having the professional experience to try and, again, give a bit more of a voice to people in the corridors of power.
Yeah, so an extraordinarily hard chapter of your life,
yeah.
But you're using it ever since then. I mean, we're talking 15 years now.
Yeah,
I think since you came out of that journey of giving back. It's wrong of me to deep dive into your personal medical records. But it's not wrong of me to talk about incontinence on an incontinence podcast. So,
absolutely not.
Can you talk us through, so the end of your period of time in hospital, You've got a stoma bag.
Yes.
Talk us through that.
Yeah. So, well, first of all, I would say to people when you're going into having a stoma, like some people come to it by, you know, trauma, right? They don't have a conversation before having it. They may be in an accident or something. But for people like me who come through an IBD background, you should absolutely always make sure you're having conversations before the surgery. And I think that's so much better now than when I had mine. And I should say, like, I did have my surgery like 16 years ago. And so much in terms of innovation has changed, but not just in products and stuff, but the services and the thought processes about the attitude to towards having a stoma. Like back then, I knew no one. Like, we didn't even have the internet to search stuff. Like, it sounds really old. Like, I'm making myself up really old. But that was just the case. So your stoma nurse was your everything. And they are your everythings. Like, my stoma nurses have been the best people I have known, because the surgeons are incredible, but the stoma nurses will talk to you about sex, about what to wear, about all the things that nobody else wants or has the time to answer. So this, having good stoma care provision is incredibly important in terms of nurses. But I remember that moment when I woke up and it's like, it was a very long surgery. So I went in originally to have a J pouch. So I didn't go in to have a permanent stoma. I went in to have a J pouch. So essentially that what that is where they bring, mine was a small intestine. So I have an ileostomy. There are, for people who don't know, there's three kinds of stomas in terms of the abdomen. There's an ileostomy, which is off the ileum, a colostomy off the colon, and there's urostomy, which is to do with the wee bits, right? So I had an ileostomy because that's where the disease was in my large bowel. So they took all of that out. They left what's called the anal stump, which is the name of my future band, if I ever had one. It's pretty rock and roll, isn't it? So they left in the anal stump.
And that's quite high up in the digestive process.
So the anal stump is, so where mine was, my whole bowel was completely done for with ulcerative colitis. It started off at 50 centimeters and then it just spread rapidly, like wildfire, really. And they took, literally, I remember at uni, unfortunately, I couldn't get an appointment and we scraped together a bit of money to go privately and went to this hospital and they shoved a bit up my bum. It was a flexi-sigmoidoscopy kind of thing. And they were like, he's like, oh yeah, you're like riddled. Like, thanks so much.
Giant.
So they took me straight into the hospital and then I went on and off treatment for years. I was on lots of steroids. So I got what's called Cushing's disease. So I put on a lot of weight. I didn't look like myself. Like, my body image was all time low. I mean, I wasn't like an Olympian like you, but I was pretty fit. Right? Yeah. So that idea of body image of having looked like one thing and then looking like another whilst also battling the indignity of what it felt like of just like pooing yourself constantly. I mean, I was at uni going to the toilet in plastic bags because I couldn't get to the toilet in time in a shared household. Like, that was the reality of it. So when I woke up with that stoma bag, you wake up with a clear one and it's filled with like, it looks like it's bright green and stuff because you've got like fluids and antibiotics and other stuff. And then after that, that's the one thing. And then you wake up and you think, oh my God, is this me forever? And you never, I don't think you ever get over that trauma of your body looking like that. And obviously you've got, I had a huge laparotomy. I've got beautiful scars. I look like the Union Jack. Laparotomy is where they open up the middle of your tummy. So to access it. So a lot of people now will have their stomas done. So just through a few little holes, but mine back then was the whole thing. So they opened me all up. And like I say, so I went in for the J pouch, but unfortunately I had huge complications and about a week later I was leaking feces into my abdomen and my laparotomy opened. And then we began my journey with MRSA and C. difficile and infection and 9 stone weight loss, where I came out eventually I had another stoma bag and then I came out actually in a wheelchair and because I'd lost so much weight and muscle and then eventually went through lots of physio and rehab with people sort of 4 times my age just to be able to tap my toe to the left or to the right. But to tell you what, considering all that, that's my story. Things have changed a lot in terms of innovation. I wouldn't change it for the world. I love my stoma. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. I love it.
I'm desperate to talk about this. You've both given me and us some really amazing insights into how that journey started for you. For both of you, this is for the last 15 years or so, to bring us up to 2025. What have you learned from the last 15 years and what are you excited about for the next 5 years and beyond? So I think Jack, that's a little bit of ISC life.
No, it just seems normal. It I would say it's enabling. I don't feel that I can not do anything. Actually, one thing I can't do very well is swimming in an indoor pool, especially if I've got a little bit of an infection coming, because that makes my bladder go into spasm, whereas normally I can't really feel my bladder. And so what I've found is going swimming, especially with the wetsuit on, is actually quite invigorating and warming, because the urine just fills up your wetsuit and you can swim quite a long way that way, I find. So that has been enabling. And it, in all seriousness, having found out about little catheters that you can throw away, I just think loads of people should know about it, and people don't. Even now, my friends say, well, how do you get that in? And I'm not actually going to show them, but it is amazing, the lack of awareness. Whereas for me, it's just not a problem. It's wonderful. It's life enhancing.
On our next episode, Pete, Jack and Hannah talk about innovation in continence healthcare. There are lots of amazing charities that can provide focused support depending on your particular needs, as well as lots of information at collarplus.co.uk. Thank you for listening to Incontinence Talks, and remember to consult your GP if you have any worries about your own continence.